So who thought we would be back aboard Voyager so soon?
I know, right? In season one territory as well.
Yeah.
Potentially dodgy. Actually, it's quite the reverse, isn't it?
Mm. Yeah. I was hugely surprised. I knew that I liked Seska. And so this is an episode brought to you by the Martha Hackett Appreciation Society. She really, she's incredibly great.
Do you remember her as that Romulan in Deep Space Nine?
Oh, I can picture her.
She appeared in The Search Part 1 and 2, and she was supposed to be a regular on DS9, and then the role of Seska came up. They poached her for Voyager. Right. So we've got an even better role for you.
And she's really good. She's really great.
She's terrific.
I think for me watching this, it reminded me that the Voyager premise was interesting and not just kind of, oh, you know, there's McKee so we can have fights and stuff like that. But, you know, they're stranded somewhere. They don't know anyone. They're surrounded by enemies. Their supplies are limited. And there's a lot of people out there who are dissatisfied with the decision that Janeway made to strand them there. Kind of deliberately. And I think it's a premise that really informs this episode and makes it really good.
I said to you when we very first started talking about Voyager was that this was a premise with potential that you watch Caretaker and you say, wow, this has got legs. Mm. They can really run with this. Now, admittedly, it was Battlestar Galactica that ran with the premise.
Yeah.
And Voyager, essentially, after Series 2 went for, let's do a load of, you know, TNG light episodes.
Yeah.
But there are a couple of episodes in series one and there are a couple of episodes in series two that really lean into this premise of being stuck out in the wilderness and dissent amongst the crew and the idea that they do need to make alliances with people in order to survive out here.
Yeah.
And this episode, this is one of two back-to-back episodes. I said this in the tag at the end of the last episode. You got Prime Factors, which is about acquiring technology to escape the Delta Quadrant back to the Alpha Quadrant and that going horribly wrong. And Seska's a big part of that. Seska's the person that basically says, no, I don't care if Janeway is saying no, we're going to go down and steal it. And she convinces B'Elanna Torres to go down there and get it. But the twist of that one is that Chewbacca got there first and he's like, no, I'm going down to get it. And then he gives a fantastic reason as to why he did that in a brilliant scene with Kate Mulgrew. Sorry, I digress.
I want to just say one thing. Those aliens in Prime Factors are later all assimilated by the Borg, as we discover in Picard Season 1.
So no,
it
for
has
real?
A happy ending. Yep.
Oh my god! Because that man in that episode, right?
So
the performers
annoying.
Is like,
yep.
I'm gonna speak to my government, Captain. You see, he talks in this very strange way.
But
the way she says when she gives him a gift from Voyager, she goes, "I'm going to give you a gift, pecan pie." Honestly,
Mulgrew can make any line absolutely.
But anyway. But that leans into the premise. And then this one does too. This is about a traitor on Voyager that's made contact with the Kazon. And I think this is the first time the Kazon are in it since Caretaker as well.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And it's a big mystery. Well, I mean, ain't much of a mystery. Originally, this episode was going to be called Seska. Do you know that?
That would have given
Which
it away.
Rather would have blown. It would be like a, you know, a Poirot episode, a Poirot story with the killer as the title. You know, it's a bit daft. But the suspense of there's somebody in our ranks that's working against us, it works really, really well in this episode. And I think there are enough layers and there's enough sort of red herrings to make the payoff very satisfying.
I have to say that I had watched this before. Obviously, I've watched all of Voyager, mostly back in the day. I haven't revisited a lot of episodes since then. And I had kind of forgotten the twist and it worked on me. And it was a bit of a relief. I just thought, oh, Chakotay, you're being a massive dumbass. What's the point of you? And then it turns out that they were a step ahead. And in a way, it has the same sort of resolution as Counterpoint, where we see kind of Janeway apparently defeated only to discover that she's actually already sorted things out. And so the same thing happens here. And it's really satisfying, I think.
Well, it's more satisfying because she gets that wonderful moment at the end where she utterly condemns Janeway, Chakotay, and the Federation amazing. But what is very un-Voyager-like is how they set this up. So Seska's been in four episodes before this.
Yep.
And that's not like Voyager to kind of sit on a surprise for that long.
Yep.
And Carey, who is the other person that's implicated in this episode, in an episode earlier in the season, it's him and Blanca Torres vying for chief engineer position. But there's like a whole subplot about it. And then obviously he loses out to her. So you can actually buy into the idea that he might have done it. So that's been set up as well. So they're using a lot of stuff that they've already kind of embedded in the season to give this very satisfying play. They don't do this at all. Sort of post series two, they don't do long form storytelling like this at all. It is just sort of one standalone after another.
Yeah, it's a bit of a shame.
It's the Pillar effect. I'm telling you, I know I talk about Michael Pillar a lot, but he had a big hand in this episode and he had a big hand in structuring series one and series two, which is where the sort of the big arcs are in Voyager. And he's very, very proud of this episode. So is Rick Berman. But Jeri Taylor, interestingly,
she didn't like it.
She's quoted as saying, "I thought it was okay."
Wow.
Whereas the next episode, which is a comedy episode about the Doctor playing Beowulf, she's quoted as saying was absolutely fantastic. So you can see where her head is that she's thinking what the audience wants and the way TV is going is where it was 10 years ago, sort of these standalone, fun, family-friendly sort of Star Trek, whereas Pillar is trying to push this show in a more interesting direction, a more sort of dynamic storytelling direction. And you've got the two of them fighting here. So in series one and two of Voyager, you get a mix of really interesting sort of experiments and terribly bland standalones.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about Star Trek or Star Trek The Next Generation or Strange New Worlds, their premise is there's a Starfleet ship that is going from planet to planet doing things. And it's a really light premise and it just means we can do Star Trek episodes. But Voyager starts with a much heavier premise than that. And so does Deep Space Nine. You know, they're set in specific places with people who've undergone a particular kind of thing, which makes them both different from just a normal Star Trek show. And what we get here is a kind of battle between, are we a Star Trek show or are we a show set in the Star Trek universe? And the great thing about Voyager, I think, as a premise, is it can do both. And what it decides to do is just throw away the premise eventually. And I think that's a shame. And you've got Deep Space Nine, you know, on the other side, on the other network, amassing this massive cast of secondary characters, creating an interesting world, doing things with the premise and exploring things. And Voyager throws that away. And in a way, I wonder if it's inevitable or not, because I certainly remember at the time us thinking, well, what happens? Aren't they going to move out of Kazon space? They're a ship that's voyaging. They're going somewhere. Yeah. And maybe that was inevitable, that this particular threat goes away. And certainly it seems satisfying when they deal with them when we move out of Kazon space altogether and start meeting the Bomar and stuff like that. But, but you know,
do you remember the Bomar arc? Oh, that was riveting, wasn't it?
Yeah. So,
remember the episode where they all had to dress up as Bomar and put white coat hangers around their heads? Oh, that was amazing. That
terrific
one.
Stuff. But, you know, like when you look back at Voyager, I think the problem ends up not being so much that they lean into doing Star Trek, but that it's just not as well done as it could have been. And under Michael Pillar, even if we moved away from the Kazon, we would have found more interesting arcs and more complex things and maybe an attempt to make the ship seem a bit more lived in as well.
But what Pillar was doing, he was starting to amass a number of like reoccurring characters like Seska, like Color, like Suda, the serial killer. And I think that would have continued, but obviously he left and they wiped everybody out and c'est la vie. It's a bit of a double-sided coin, Voyager, isn't it? Because like to walk away from the premise means that it's exciting because you get a new threat, yeah, like the Borg come along or the Herojian, but you don't amass that sort of backstory and continuity. There's nothing to play about with. You're constantly resetting all the time.
Yeah.
So it's just, it doesn't have the substance or the depth of something like DS9 or even TNG.
Yeah. I mean, TNG doesn't have a massive kind of cast of semi-regulars, really. Certainly not to the extent that DS9 doesn't.
More than you think, you know. If you look at it, it's more than you think.
Well, I mean, we get Samantha and Naomi Wildman eventually, and we get the Borg kiddies and stuff. So there are, you know, great, eh? So I guess there's that. But there isn't really an attempt to deal with what it's like to be stranded, you know. And here there is.
Yeah, that's such a shame. And like I said to you on our chat, that this is one of a handful of episodes that is uniquely Voyager.
Yeah.
Like this could not be any other Star Trek show.
No.
And I think there's probably as many episodes of DS9, like DS9, probably about 2/3 are uniquely DS9, you know? And Voyager, there's probably about 10, 15 episodes maybe. Yeah. And most of them are in the first two series. Yeah. Eye of the Needle. Good God, help me out now. Basics, part one is kind of uniquely Voyager. And then sort of in latter seasons, you get the odd one like Timeless, where they're stranded on the ice planet. That's one where they're trying to go home and using technology goes horribly wrong, but they're few and far between, aren't they?
Well, yeah. And eventually I think probably the whole bulk of that arc is shouldered by Dwight Schultz and Marina in the semi-regular episodes that they're in.
Pathfinder, that's another one.
And like those are fun, but we never really get the sense, because it's just going to be a Starfleet crew and they're all going to be the best of the best and, you know, none of them feels homesick or anything like that. So we never really, really get a proper feel for what the premise could have been. And in a way, I ended up thinking that maybe we're in the Delta Quadrant just to get out of Deep Space Nine's way so that Deep Space Nine can do things that don't affect Voyager and vice versa.
I was reading about the conception of Voyager this morning and they're quoted as saying, well, we need to do something new. We just can't do Next Generation again. Ironic. So let's go to a completely new region of space. And they said they wanted to tap into like the original series where they're on that 5-year mission and they were going out and exploring space for the first time. And this, you know, that's what the Delta Quadrant is, a brand new region of space. But then they did go and make a load of TNG episodes. You know, I think when they realized the ratings, you know, they weren't holding, they were like, well, I guess people just want more TNG. Let's do that instead.
Yeah.
And what's annoying is you get to like Endgame. Even Endgame isn't uniquely Voyager. Yeah, they're trying to get home, but what is it? It's a time travel episode. There's two Janeways and it's the Borg.
Yeah.
That's all TNG. It's sad. Anyway, let's not talk about, you know, in the future. Let's talk about now, because I'll tell you what, this has got Seska in it and she's amazing.
Yeah, this is a pretty great episode. All right, what do you think? Should I count us in?
I think we've ranted enough. Okay. Yes.
All right. Well, here goes. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, and we're off.
Do you know, I only ran because of the untapped potential.
Because
in
care.
Episodes like this, it shows the potential was there.
So here we are in Southern California in a very, very low effort planet, but we're outside.
Excuse me.
I was so excited.
Yeah.
So excited.
The second this started, right, and they're on location, I just saw your face beaming.
But it is a pretty shitty planet. And actually, I think that Neelix is super annoying here. And he's...
No, wait. He gets a great physical joke, though. He's talking about this horrible fruit.
There he is, pointing at his dick.
He points at his penis. Yeah, it's so funny.
What do you think? Chakotay grabs his arm so he doesn't kind of go in for a feel? Like, what's happening there? Like, anyway.
Well, you know, that's Rick Berman there.
I think so. So here we are.
No, none of that.
Leola Root, it turns out, is ginger painted inexpertly yellow with a leaf stuck on the end.
The amount of jokes they get out of this
Leola Root. Yeah.
We're talking about Leola Root stew for the next 7 years. Get used to it.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Oh, well, that's a peculiarly Voyager thing. Can I say how stupid these uniforms look when you have a tricorder and a gun, like, in your pocket sticking out in front of you? Like, they look so stupid. They make them look like pajamas more than they usually do, I think. They're pretty terrible.
Can I say how appalling it is that we are, you know, this is one of the first chances of a Voyager to go out, you know, the Voyager crew to get out in the sun and all that. And we're not actually, you know, I know you're going to say I'm comparing this unfavorably to Enterprise's Strange New World. But at least when they got out of the runabout in that, they were excited to be outside in the fresh air.
Yeah.
That bunch are just scavenging around looking a bit bored.
Yeah. Part of the problem is just that the planet looks so boring, but you know, what can they do?
At the end of the season, right, in the 37th, I think it's the beginning of season two, they land Voyager on Southern California.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. It's great to see Voyager land. I love how it can do that. That is pretty good.
Dreadful episode, though, but it does look pretty spectacular, bad. I've got to say, for the time. Okay, so here we go. Neelix wants to bring back blood worms for his Tartar.
So that means everyone looks very amused
by that.
Raw blood worms.
Yeah. Ooh. Well, I don't know. Isn't that like black pudding?
Oh, I don't know.
That's blood, isn't it?
Yeah, but you don't eat that raw, though, do you?
I'm not sure. It's delicious.
Oh, God.
So the Kazon are approaching. Kazon ships are on their way.
Oh,
is there one here already? No, there's one here already.
Yeah. It's invisible. We don't know why.
That's right. Have they got cloaking devices then?
No, there's actually dialogue in here about this that there's that someone has taught them how to avoid Voyager's sensors. So, yes.
Well, I wonder who that was.
I have no idea. So,
everybody seems to be here except for one person.
Yeah. And we're establishing Joe Carey here. And so he apparently just disappears from the show and then just comes back in series six to be
so
killed.
Funny. Like, he vanishes in series two, right?
Yeah.
In series two and then comes back for one episode
and then they kill him off. Oh, it's series seven, is it?
Come on.
Yeah. So miserable.
Honestly.
Yeah, I'm kind of hoping that we get a few more people on board the Enterprise in Strange New Worlds next series. We've had some sort of regular background people and we had, what's-his-face, Kirk's brother. But it'd be kind of nice. I do like, you know, the extra characters just – it's always the same seven people doing every fucking thing on these stupid starships and it's kind of nice if we have more people. Is this a set?
I think these caves are real.
I think that what they
because
you can see
he comes around
the
corner now. Yeah, he's gone from outside. The camera's gone from outside in, and then they're dripping.
Yeah.
And that doesn't normally happen in your stock Star Trek cave number 52.
It's
does it?
Number one, obviously. So I think we may actually move to the cave set because I'm not convinced by whatever that big ass fucking stalagmite is there that looks like it's made out of.
I think the lighting's very good here though, and I do like the dripping.
It does make it real. No, I think it makes it real. It makes it less like a set. It, you know, like there's water in it. I think that helps.
See, now look, I wouldn't have bought into this whole thing about, oh, I was picking mushrooms for you to make your soup, but then they pay that off after the title music with a great scene
between Seska and Chakotay,
that's
scene.
A really important scene for the episode because it establishes their relationship.
Yeah, I think it's good. I really enjoyed it, actually. I think, you know, anyway, it's a bit cheesily written,
I think at this
whatever.
Point we don't know enough about the Kazon for them to be annoying. Like, I think there's an episode in series two called Initiations, I want to say.
Yes.
It's got Aaron Eisenberg in it as a young Kazon warrior.
And is
it's
he called
not
Car?
A bad character episode. It's called Car. Yes.
Dumb name
but
for
that
alien.
Is the episode that really establishes them as like cult Klingons.
Yeah.
And they've just got rituals. And it's basically just the Klingons. Whereas in season one, you don't really see that much of them. So they're kind of like a background menace more than anything.
Yeah. I mean, even giving them the first letter and the same, like the same first letter and the same last two letters, like Klingon, Kazon, seems like a dumb idea. And like there is that.
And the makeup's pretty similar as well, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah,
like,
that's true.
Bumpy foreheads.
Yeah. So when we meet the Trabe, do you remember what episode that is?
Oh my, it's a great episode as well. Yeah. Oh my God, what's it called?
Because it's
halfway through season two. Yeah. It's the one where Janeway, you know, makes friendship with the Trabe, and then she's like, right, we're going to bring all the sex together, and then the Trabe try and wipe them all out with a massive spaceship that comes down and tries to destroy the room they're in.
And it's kind of terrible because it's kind of like, oh, these are nice white people and we're going to be their friends. And it turns out, you know, that the tribal people who are all fighting one another have just been routinely kind of oppressed and exploited by the Trabe. It's really good.
The guy playing like the head Trabe is so amiable.
Yeah. And it just turns out he's horrifically evil. It's wonderful. I think it's good.
Alliances. That's what the episode is called. Yeah. Alliances.
Yeah.
Oh, it's a fantastic episode. State of Flux. What does that mean in this?
Well, I actually think that it's that the relationships among the crew are in a state of flux. And it looks like it's a title about space things, but there's no real space things. It's, you know, we're in a state of flux, that Chakotay is having to deal with the fact that he's second in command, but also the commander of the McKee, you know, the former captain of the McKee ship or whatever. So I think that that's what it's about, because I can't think what else it is. There's nothing spacey that
I'll tell you
be.
All right. If this episode would be a lot poorer without the scene that we're watching right now. Yeah. So it's the scene where Seska brings Chakotay mushroom soup and details how with a, you know, clandestine marquee operation, they managed to gain access to Neelix's kitchen with a wonderful comedy moment where she goes, well, the emergency must be over. So, and then it's like, Neelix to Chakotay.
Yeah. I thought that was really well timed. That was good.
Seska's been in my kitchen.
I actually wondered whether they cut the actual thing where they steal the mushrooms and then just turn it into this messenger speech from Seska, because it does seem extremely detailed, and it just seems like maybe it was a scene, and maybe it might have been better if we'd seen it rather than having Seska come in and just talk about it.
But this scene makes me like Seska a lot.
Yeah.
Like, she's really fun in this scene. And actually, this is the scene which makes me think, oh, Chakotay, because he's laughing with her until it gets to the point where she kind of breaks the rules. And then he's like, right, you're having no replicators. I'm like, oh, Chakotay, come on.
Except, though, that we're in a situation here where things are scarce. And so she's taking stuff that, you know, she's taking other people's share, essentially. And so,
and essentially, she's also leading into that divide between the Marquis and the Federation as well, isn't she? Like, this was a Marquis operation. We're going we're doing this.
Yeah.
And you're ex Marquis and we're doing this for you. It's, I get it.
Yeah, I know I know that it looks like it's a conflict between Marquis values and Federation values, but I also think it is like she is stealing stuff from the other crew members. And later on, when we get to the speech where she denounces the Federation, what she's denouncing the Federation for, or what she's denouncing Janeway for, is refusing to allow the Kazon to kill all the Ocampers. Because that's the moral dilemma at the end of Caretaker.
Well, she says the incomprehensible decision of a Starfleet captain.
If this
captain
had been a Cardassian ship, we'd have been home by now. And you kind of go, that's the fucking point, though, isn't it? And so,
oh, I don't know though. She's so much more charismatic than anyone else. I just want to listen to her. What she looks like, you know.
Yeah.
That's how all good, dictators start.
Yeah.
They're very likable people.
Well, I think actually Janeway can outdoes her enormously.
Moments in this. She's got some wonderful acting moments in this. But when she comes up behind him and gives him a hug there, and she kind of shuts her eyes, and actually buy the relationship.
Yeah, we didn't know about it before now.
No, I don't think. I think there was kind of hints and whispers. Right.
Yeah.
But no, it's never been explicitly stated until this point. And I was kind of like, okay, this is nice. And this is believable. And so throughout him kind of having his head turned by her, it makes sense. He's got feelings for her. You know, he doesn't want to believe it. And it's not until there's incontrovertible proof that he actually, you know, and turns against her.
She says, and I'm inclined to think that we're meant to believe her, that she had feelings for him as well. She wasn't just faking it.
I believe that too, though. Yeah. I think that...
No, well, I think that's what the show wants us to believe.
She's exploiting him.
Yeah.
And she has been for a long time, but somewhere along the line, she genuinely had feelings for him.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I love this bit in a minute. Not only because the lighting is extremely dramatic. And we were talking last week about how, you know, it can be quite flat in 90s Trek.
Yeah.
They beam onto the Kazon ship and it's all very X-Files-y. They've all got torches going and stuff. Not only that, but you like Voyager didn't really throw much kind of crazy imagery at you. And the image of the Kazon sticking out of a bit of stone is really ghoulish.
Yeah, that is pretty good, isn't it? Because, I mean, we've had this, you know, wrecked spaceship set that we go on to investigate. And they've got sort of sexier torches now in Voyager than they had in Next Gen. Remember Next Gen, they had the square ones that they have to hold in their hand and stuff. They've got these sort of double-barreled ones that are strapped to their wrist. Or something which seem a bit cooler. But I mean, this is the sort of set that we've seen before in Star Trek. This is the sort of thing we know that they can do. But this is super strange.
That's great. The way the guy's cheek is literally fused into the stone is really scary. And it makes the point that they are not capable of handling this technology.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's partly Seska's fault.
Why do you think she gave them the wrong instructions and tried to bump some of them off?
I don't know. So we learn that it doesn't have proper... I think that this is the most disturbing thing here, is that if you don't properly shield your food replicator, it will just kind of meld you into the floor and shit. That does seem...
Well, that's good as well, because you're probably thinking, well, you know, she's trying to give them weapons or something like that. So the bit where... it's not until later in the episode, Balan Torre says, of all the things to lose your life over, it's a food replicator.
They established
in Caretaker, they don't have, they never follow up on this, but they don't have access to water. So to have a food replicator absolutely would change the balance of power amongst the Kazon sex.
Yeah, that's right. Water's a big thing, isn't it, in that first episode? It's
because Neelix, do you remember, he comes along and has a bath and goes, immerse myself in water.
That's the first scene between Neelix and Chubong. It's very funny.
While he's in the bath. He goes,
can I get one of those replicators to get a uniform like yours? And Chubong just looks at him deadpan and goes, no, you certainly cannot.
Although he did wear one in the last Voyager episode that we watched, which is kind of delightful.
Did he?
Yeah, he was a security officer, wasn't in the future.
Before and after, okay, so now they've taken the one remaining Kazon that's not fused into something to sickbay.
But he's not very well. Now.
There's a great scene with him later as well, isn't it, when Kala comes on the ship.
It's really good, isn't it? Because we spend a lot of time caring about this. So we want him to be alive partly because we're Federation and we're great guys and stuff. And I'm not dismissing that. I think that's a good thing. And in fact, Kala gets told that, doesn't he, when it's kind of like everyone on the ship helped to donate blood or something, or people on the ship donated blood in order to save this man.
Yeah,
like we've gone to great lengths to do that. And so it isn't just so that we can find out who sold you the replicator or whatever, because I mean at this point they don't even know that.
It's not explicitly stated, because he's then killed after Kala kills him when after that scene where she says that, you know, they donated blood. But I wonder if that is part of the reason why, because they're shown later that they, you know, they don't want to, they like to keep themselves pure, you know?
Yeah. But I think that it's because Kala doesn't want Seska to be outed.
Exposed.
Yeah. I think that's probably it. It isn't said explicitly why it happens. And it is a good scene. It is quite shocking, actually, because we have kind of invested a reasonable amount of time in the episode, you know, making sure that he's okay. And this scene is so good. Look at her response to option 3. I don't like number three at all.
She's so
good. And no other captain would have had to worry about this. This is not something that, you would worry about the crew are giving technology to other people.
You could just toss them into prison. If this was happening in the Alpha Quadrant, you know, you could absolutely hand them over to the authorities. They are the authority here,
No one else would be motivated to do it. You live on a starship, you know, you get all those lovely meals and stuff and lovely quarters and things. You know, no one's disaffected on board a starship, but here there are people who are disaffected because they've been isolated from their families and stranded here because of a command decision, you know.
And what's wonderful then is it just opens out suspicion onto everybody. But obviously, initially, they're all thinking, well, it's got to be a Marquee member.
Yeah.
You know, they were forced onto this ship, into this situation, into this command structure.
Yeah. But I mean, all of the Starfleet people, I think they make a good decision. So eventually it just settles down to suspecting one of two people, one of whom is Starfleet and one of whom's a Marquee. And I think...
Like, even though in the back of our heads, because there's something in Marv Hackett's performance that just means you know it's her. So the real suspense comes in how they're going to catch her out.
But they play on that in the way that the story is designed, like in the way the story is resolved. The way that they find out that it's Seska is because Seska
tries to implicate herself
in order to prove that it's Carrie, right? Yeah. And so I think that she seems too obvious. She's so villainous. She's already been stealing food from other people on the ship, so we know that she's willing to steal things, you know. And so maybe that's too obvious, and so we start to suspect that it's really Carrie, which would be an exciting twist.
How long they wait for her to come back after this. It's halfway through season two. It's maneuvers in season two. So they almost wait a whole season, which makes her return when she comes up. Hello, Chakotay. You're like, yes, she's back. And that's the first time you see her in full Cardassian makeup because obviously you don't see her in it. And then we get a half season of all these Seska appearances where she gets more grandiose.
Brilliant. Leading up to basics, obviously, when they take over the ship and steal it.
I still think one of the best scenes ever in Chakotay, in Voyager, is when she turns up and goes, and this is your baby, Chakotay. It's so, God, it's so terrible. Really great, I love it. Isn't it? Oh, dear, oh, dear. Oh, that's right. So he's now assigning her to the bridge to show to everybody that he trusts her, because you wouldn't put someone you don't trust on the bridge.
Yeah. Yeah, look. I mean,
love all these dynamics. Yeah, it's just so not Voyager.
And, like, she's worried about her reputation because she's been taken off this mission publicly. And here, like, I buy this as well. She doesn't want to be outed. She's concerned that he will wake up and recognize her, say, hey, you know, here's the receipt that I promised you.
Like, I wonder if you're supposed to think she's concerned for him. Actually, she's concerned he's gonna spill. That's the trouble.
No, but I think she, even if she's like, she's concerned, just imagine she's not the villain, right? If we think that she's not, she's been unjustly suspected, she wants him to turn up to wake up and not recognize her, right? And so this is not suspicious behavior from our point of view as an audience trying to work out what's happening, I think.
What I think is really clever is they put a twist within the twist.
Yeah.
So, like, even if you kind of guessed, she's the one giving them the technology, you never would have guessed, actually, she's a Cardassian and she never was a Marquee at all.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, at Martha Hackett's, there's a quote from her on Memory Alpha going, you know, I read this script and I thought, oh my God, she's evil. And then, oh my God, she's a Cardassian. She's double evil. Like, she loved it.
I bet. And it gives her great stuff to do. But, you know, even the reveal that she's a Cardassian, there's a moment where she explains to Chakotay what she says really happens.
That is a Trek cliche, you know, where they say, absolutely. I was on this labor camp. It's a
DS9 cliche.
Yeah. Well, he had Kalanora syndrome.
Yeah.
And that's why he's, you know, he's not Maritza. So it's kind of something we've done before. So we're like, oh, okay, so we can't buy into this.
Well, that, we do know that's the sort of thing that happened, you know, like that.
It reminds me of that wonderful bit in The Serene Squall where she goes, did you really buy into that terrible backstory I gave you?
That you were complaining about. This. That's right.
But they don't, in 90s Trek at this point, they're not going to take the piss out of the cliches quite like that yet.
But it's kind of funny because we're not in a position to judge whether that's credible or not. And so it looks like Chakotay believes it. And then, of course, there's another twist where he knew that that was all bullshit because the Doctor had ruled it out already as a possibility.
Now, you said to me when we were talking off mic that this might be the point where Chakotay stopped being a credible character. But actually, I think in season two, there's one episode where he goes after Seska.
Yeah.
And he's determined to like bring her down, which works really well. And then there's an episode towards the end of the season where him and Jane were having almost romance.
Yeah.
But I think at the end of season two, that's when he stops offering anything of worth to the show.
Yeah. And like he has an interesting role here because he's not just the person who, I mean, I don't even know what Chakotay does in a normal episode in series four. Like, does he read out things? He sits next to Janeway.
He sits next to Janeway and says things like, you know, oh, yes, you're fiddling with your comm badge. That must mean you're...
yeah, that's right. It's your tell.
You're having a tough time making a decision or something like that. You know, dreadful banter like that.
Yeah. So he's given stuff to do and he's given an interesting position to be in because he's got loyalties as the first officer of the ship, but as leader of the McKee, and he sympathizes with the McKee.
As lover to Seska.
It's
a triple whammy, really.
Yeah. And like, I don't think he's that good. Like, I don't think Robert Beltran great.
No. I tell you what, though, there's something hot about him in early Voyager. Yeah, he's got a touch of grey to his hair before he started dyeing it, you know? Yeah.
No, I mean, and I like him a lot better than I like the other Robert, to be honest. But
excuse me. Robert Picardo, how dare you?
Oh, God, everyone's called Robert on this fucking show. I mean, Robert Duncan McNeil. Why are three people called Robert? That's crazy. No, there should be a Screen Actors Guild rule about it. So,
but you know what? This is anti before and after, you know. This is focusing on all the characters we love on Voyager.
Yeah,
we've got a good role for Bilana Torres. You've got a good role for Janeway. You got a good role for Seska.
Yeah.
You know, and Harry Kim and... Tom Paris, I've shunted to the sidelines and don't do anything of note.
Do we even see Harry in this episode?
Yeah, he was just there delivering some technobabble about the case on chips.
Okay, that's so boring. Okay.
Bit thankless, but he was there.
Yeah, okay. He's barely in it though, isn't he?
Kez gets a nice little scene where she's, you know, talking about the blood with Seska.
Yeah. And although, Tuvok.
Her early hair. What was going on with that early hair?
Yeah, I thought I liked that.
Is that a wig?
Yeah, it's a wig, obviously. She only ever wears a wig.
Terrible, honestly. Yeah. Why would you deliberately make someone as beautiful as Jennifer Lien look awful?
I don't know. She's supposed to look very elfin, strange. I think, is the idea.
Do you think Carey looks a bit like Chief O'Brien?
Yeah, he's kind of like your low-rent, you know, non-union Mexican equivalent of Colm Meaney, I think. And he is Irish. Well, his name's Carey, isn't it?
Well, say, Yeah. I think that Janeway's been looking through the archives, right, at Captain Pike and seeing how fabulously high his hair goes, and she's trying to match it. honestly, it's enormous, her hair.
Yeah. I don't know about her season one hair. I kind of was hoping for just a normal French curl. I think this is a sort of weird look. But, you know, it's got a sort of...
It looks like she's wearing a hat, you know, like a Russian hat.
Yeah.
You know, you've got to remember, though, at this point in the run, those execs are still on the set for every episode watching everything she's doing.
Yeah.
Is she okay to
she
do
too
this?
Too feminine.
Man, oh, man. Look at her there, look.
I know.
I'd like to believe you, Mr. Carey.
She's really great. She's so good. So good.
I think her best moment is when she confronts Colour, though.
I think she has two stunning moments, but the confrontation with Colour is spectacular. So
I don't
good.
Like bullies, and I don't like you, Colour.
That's really good. I don't like threats. It's a tricolon. I don't like threats. I don't like bullies, and I don't like you, Colour. It's so good.
Oh,
and she's so
man.
Solid delivery. She's great.
I'm entirely convinced.
And
you know,
that
like,
is a good
they...
line. Look at that. She spent the last 2 years as an enemy of the Federation, and he just says, "So have I." And I think that's properly interesting line.
You know, you've bought into me being a part of this crew, so you should buy into her too.
And that sort of stuff. There's so much to be done.
There's certainly enough here for there to be the possibility that she didn't do it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Even when we know she did. Yeah, we absolutely know she did.
Yeah. But I think that's the thing, that she's too obvious. And what would be more interesting is if it turns out to be Carey who's missing his mum or something, you know.
Can I just say, this man playing Marsh Colour, okay, he gets quite a few appearances in Series 2. He's Seska's bit on the side, you know, she's playing him on a long string. I think he's not as good as, but he actually has got a bit of charisma.
Oh, yeah, I think he's
that
great.
That sort of Mark Alamo charisma,
I think he's really properly good in this. And
like
striking looking. Don't you think? He looks really...
stupid fucking hair. What is that hair all about?
But
on the Beaumont scale, I give him a 8.7.
It is pretty stupid, isn't it? But he's got a really angular face. He's got really strong features. I think he's great.
But what's wonderful is how in Season 2, Seska emasculates him, you know, and he's like posturing and she's there in his ear going, "Yes, Marsh." But I also think you should divert to this course, Marsh. You know,
I think he's really impressive as well. You know how they try and go for sort of grunty, animalistic kind of delivery when you're a Klingon? And he doesn't. Yeah. He's very posh and clipped and stuff. I think he's really good. And he's quite calm too and a bit genial.
Yeah, it is that Gold Dukat effect, isn't it?
Yeah.
Of like the sort of villain that you want to hang with.
Yeah, I think he's really terrific. And just the fact that she sort of fairly effortlessly refuses to be intimidated by him. You know, she has the upper hand.
You know, earlier in the episode where Neelix goes, you know, "Captain, you shouldn't go after these Kazon ships. This could be a trap." And she says, "Yeah, but, you know, we're going to be humane and we're going to help them out anyway." I love that bit.
Yeah. Well, this, you know, where he says that's not acceptable and she just says, "Well, it will have to be." You know, and it's,
you know, if you turned on now, right, the way she's looking at him then, it could be like a romance scene. She's kind of giving him the eye.
She's going to slap him and then they'll kiss.
We learnt in Counterpoint that Janeway is very good at, you know, flirting outrageously and being very well aware she's talking to a villain at the same time.
I think so. I love this. It's so good, isn't it? It's sort of shockingly unexpected. I'm glad that Tuvok isn't fooled by it. It's so good.
Do you remember when they pulled off a similar trick in Basics where the Kazon man comes onto Voyager, he's like, "I'm defecting."
Yeah.
And they wait till about 2/3 into the episode and then he injects himself and literally
and
blows up about a third of the
ship. Right. Yeah, that's right.
That's really great. "Get off my ship."
She's so good. And she's absolutely in command. Like, he's physically massive compared to her, you know, but she has the edge. She's really, really properly good. She stands up to him so well.
I am so unused, and this is going to sound like a half-assed compliment to Voyager, having this much substance in its characterization and in its narrative. That's what really stood out for me in this, is there's just a lot, happening in this, you know?
Yeah.
And it means something. Like, it has an impact. Her being a tracer in this episode has an impact on B'Elanna Torres.
Yep.
It has an impact on Chakotay. It absolutely has an impact on Janeway because she's nearly in tears in that second to last scene.
Yeah, that's so good. I think that's her second great acting moment. I think it's so good. Such an interesting choice, not necessarily imposed on her by the script or anything. It's just a really, really good choice.
At the end of this scene, right, there's a throwaway bit of dialogue where they're going onto the bridge and Chakotay goes to Tuvok, "You were working for her. She was working for them.
Yeah.
Was anyone on that ship working for me?" I really like that bit.
Yeah,
like,
I do too.
He must literally be thinking he's, you know, the biggest bloody fool in the whole of the Marquee.
He is, turns out.
Oh, what's she doing with that?
Oh, that's a pattern enhancer. Remember pattern enhancers? We've talked about them before.
Oh, from Power Play.
Yeah.
They set that up, didn't they? And then they all did a little dive backwards.
Yeah, that's right.
I remember.
There it is. Was anyone on that ship working for me?
I prefer that kind of bit of throwaway dialogue to the scene at the end.
It's a little bit lame, but I think need it. It would have, and it doesn't make sense either, I think.
And it kind of, Chewbacca's going, how is me being fooled by her making you feel better?
Come on. I think what's really fun too is that we think it's going to be a race against time, that we have to get this evidence before the other Kazon turn up. But in fact, we get the evidence at the end of the next scene. And even Janeway is kind of, oh, all right, you're finished. Fantastic. And then then we get this. Here Holy she crap, she's good.
Honestly, she turns me on a little bit, when she's this forceful.
So terrific. Just tremendously great.
Have got supernovas in them. Did you see them?
Yeah. Look at her.
Oh my God. She's got her hands on her hips and everything.
The Janeway maneuver, we call that. You know how the Picard maneuver is when he pulls his shirt down to straighten out the wrinkles? That's the Janeway maneuver.
That's a very good shot of the power dynamics on the Voyager bridge deck, because she's there with her hands on her hips looking very authoritative and he's limping a chair next to her looking a bit useless.
What am I doing? Well, there you go. Yeah. That's exactly it.
Wonderful. And, go back to next gen, you would have had Troy looking a bit useless while Picard was looking important. That's right. Exactly. Things have changed for the better.
She is so good. Holy crap. And Balana's hair. What do we think about Balana's season one hair?
It's a little masculine, isn't it? It gets longer.
I think it's terrible. I just think it's really shockingly bad.
Look, I mean, season one, everyone's grows into their look eventually. Yeah, exactly. Look at Sisko in DS9,
Yeah, I think Neelix too actually looks a little bit weird in this episode.
I do think you and I need to do an episode that gives Roxanne Dawson a bit of focus soon because we haven't, and she is a star player on this show. She's very good.
Oh, no, we did the, horrible hologram baby episode. What's that called? Lineage. That's mostly her.
Of course, I forgot about it. Yeah, but she's been swamped out by Duncan O'Neill the whole time.
Yeah, that's true. Know? Yeah.
Okay, what's occurring now? I've lost it a bit.
They've discovered what it is, I guess, and what caused the people melting into the bulkheads problem that we saw earlier.
Oh, this is wonderful. This bit here where Seska goes, you must think I'm horrible. I think I'm a Cardassian and a traitor to them. And she really lays it on thick here. I was like, go on, Martha Hackett.
Well, in fact, it's really great because there is that scene earlier on where they're kind of conspiring together. We see her enjoying telling that story to Chakotay and him enjoying the story until it ends up with, and then I stole lots of food from everyone.
Can I ask, is there another character on Voyager with these kind of layers?
Well, it's not layers really, is it? Sort of she gets interesting plot things happen to her,
her. Masks. She's got one mask over another,
Yeah, yeah. She gets a lot of fun.
A character where they can actually play about with the possibility of who they are. And I don't know. I just don't think there's anyone as interesting as this later on. Yeah,
I don't think there is either. I mean, Seven, I think, is pretty interesting, but it's a fairly straightforward premise, and it's the actor that
it's just her rediscovering her humanity. Well,
that's interesting, I think.
Well, it's interesting because of the actress, because Jeri Ryan's so good.
Yeah.
Whereas what they settle on with Seska is supervillain, but
that's great. It's fun to have a supervillain.
When is that ever not wonderful?
That's right. That's right. The films all do supervillains, don't they? Or lots of the later films
half of them aren't as good as Seska, though.
No, that's true. Yeah.
And in fact, she's so good that even when she long departed the show, they did an episode towards the end of series 3, which was a holodeck program of Seska overthrowing the ship.
Yes, that's right. I remember that. And then
way forward in series 7, where in an episode called Shattered, where Chakotay is traveling along the Voyager timeline.
Yeah.
And one of the time zones he goes to has Seska in it. They can't quite forget about her.
I'm glad though. She is spectacular. She really is good. And this is, Seska acting and Martha acting. And I think it's pretty great. We talked about this before. It is the incredible sob story.
She says a line here that's so emasculating to Chakotay, because she says, you must have thought I did it all for your secrets. Well, let me tell you, your secrets weren't good enough. But I know what she's really saying.
Well,
there, you
except
know.
That she isn't. She says, "I only had one agenda with you, Chakotay, and you know what that was
to fuck him."
Yeah. Well, yeah. You know, and maybe that's actually kind of true. You know, she's a Cardassian that somehow ended up on this ship, and when we discover she's a Cardassian, that's not a problem. Do you know what I mean? Like, she's a Cardassian, but that's not the problem. The problem is she's kind of a bad person.
What I love about this as well is that the audience is kind of duped here, because we're at the point now where we think, oh, Chakotay's so fucking naive. Like, how is he buying this anymore?
That was me watching it.
Sick bay and goes straight up to Tuvok and says, right, she's just told me this cock and ball story. Let's watch her now. And I'm like, okay, so this is really playing some interesting games.
Yeah. Because I have a low opinion of Chakotay, I just assumed that he was being a complete patsy in this scene. And then we cut to Tuvok in a sort of interesting blocked scene there. He's so good. Holy crap.
Who, Tim Russ?
Yeah.
He's so wasted on this show. I've got some quotes from Tim Russ, you know, in my book, which when we get there, I'm going to tell you, because he's fucking scathing about
he's
the technobabble
so
in Voyager,
good.
You know.
Yeah. There are scenes of technobabble here that I think are kind of a bit crap. And
early on there was a few bits where, you know, my brain was fighting what was being said to me because it just really wasn't very interesting.
No, but I mean, then we've just done an episode before this that was entirely technobabble based. You know, it was the interaction of the chronoton radiation interacting with the biotemporal therapy. Like, it couldn't have been less
interesting. Terrifying,
like,
me
just
that
two,
you remember that, you know,
two completely bullshit things interacting to
watching
reuse a
Star
plot.
Trek's not been a waste in your brain, has it?
All the
technobabble you've got stored in there now.
That's
I'm gonna get Andre Balmanis to sign you over for the next book. All right,
now can I just tell you that this gin rummy thing, the dialogue here is about how they're going to solve the plot. And it's like, I discard enough cards to fool you about what I still have in my hand. Like, that's him describing his strategy. So I'm there going, what the fuck is this scene for? Like, why are we playing cards? What's happening here? And it is clearly just that. It's like both of them are doing that. It's a little bit like the Counterpoint stuff, which is obviously much, much better done in the episode Counterpoint, the way all that's talk about interacting spirals and music and all of that sort of thing informs us about how the episode's going to go.
I love scenes like this, you know, the suspense in this moment where you're like, oh my God, it's happening right now. They're literally moving the evidence, and the music was sort of rising a little bit. And you're like, you're on tenterhooks as to who the bloody hell is doing this.
Yeah.
Voyager doesn't have suspense like this very often.
No. Yeah. It's really good. And it matters to us because these are semi-regular characters.
This is a top 10 Voyager scene. This scene in sickbay now. This whole scene.
I quite like how Seska's decided to put some lipstick on for this scene too, because I think that she looks more vulnerable when she doesn't have her lipstick on, and now she's wearing supervillain lipstick. We kind of, you know, she's a little bit more of a force to be reckoned with, I think.
What's lovely about this is she continues to try and fool him for about 30 seconds, thinking, oh, well, you know, I've still got him wrapped around my little finger, or his penis wrapped around my little finger.
Yeah, that's right.
Until then the lights come on, and then she doesn't even have a moment where she goes all super villain. She's still talking in the same tone, but she's just like, all right, it's a fair cop, gov. And because she knows she's got a way out, we don't know yet, but she does. She plays the whole scene so cool, doesn't she?
Yeah, she's really good.
And I think what's interesting is not just her delivery, but just everybody else's silent reactions to her.
Yeah. I think this is a good speech for him, and he's getting to do things with it. Now with the lights on and all of us come in, it's time for an accusation.
Yeah, Janeway's face. Folding her arms.
So we haven't settled on EMH at this point. He's the emergency holographic medical program instead of the other way around. He doesn't get to say, please state the nature of the medical emergency here.
I mean, I'm not sure we needed a doctor for this, but they could have just said, well, we spoke to the doctor and he said, you know.
Yeah, except that we didn't get to see that scene where we spoke to the doctor. So let's give the other Robert something to do, I think.
But this is like, so it's great. We get, you know, the double whammy twist. He's just said it was you that did it. And then the doctor comes in and says, and you're a Cardassian.
But the being a Cardassian isn't the problem, is it? Like, they would have gone along with her, and it just turns up that she's a Cardassian who was caught up in this stupid thing that they did and, you know, happens to be stuck
there.
When they were taken
by the kid, she must be now, for fuck's sake, you know, I was on this covert mission with the Marquis. Yeah. And now I'm stuck here with you bunch.
Yeah. It is kind of bad luck.
You think she went to bed every night going, they're going to find out one day?
No, I think probably not. And I think part of the thing is that she clearly underestimates them as well, because they outclass her here and all of them are in on it. All of this stuff was happening behind the scenes in a way that she wasn't aware of.
She gets a brilliant bit where she's like, Federation. What did she say? Federation compassion.
Yeah.
Federation nobility. Federation honor, you know.
Yeah, she's wrong. So you know, she's wrong about the Federation here. This isn't
is
a
she?
No. This
is she
a,
wrong, Nathan?
Yes. Because
I don't think the Acampers are very interested. So no, maybe they should
not.
Have been
they are just, you know, like a completely made up threat or not threat, you know, thing to worry about. They're like the people of Viridian 3 in Star Trek Generations who he couldn't possibly give a shit about. But if the choice is between allowing the Kazon to annihilate a race of people and this single ship being inconvenienced, even if the ship had been blown up, you know, like it would have been the right course of action. It would have been the right thing to do. And she's wrong. You know.
I just love it when people. I've got a lot of issues with the Federation, you know, especially how they're portrayed in early TNG.
Yeah,
these imperialist assholes going around saying, "No, we can't help them. They let them have their drug addiction," you know.
Well, that's why
very strange.
The Federation works so well in Discovery is because we're in an era that needs cooperation and that's facing various threats that needs to work together and needs to connect and that's been isolated. You know, everyone's been isolated for one another for ages.
You know, amongst all that top dialogue she just had then, you know, condemning the Federation, the best bit is the soap opera bit where she just looks at him and goes, I can't believe I ever loved you, Chakotay. Right, now I'm going.
But that bit where Seska goes and she realizes, Janeway realizes that she can't get her back and she kind of tears up for a second and then turns around, isn't immediately back on. And that's such a great choice because, you know, this is the first season of Star Trek with a female captain. How is a female captain going to be different from a man? And it's that thing because she's the caretaker as well. That's why that first episode's called Caretaker. She has to look after this crew because there's no one else and she's lost one of them, you know.
Do you think it would have been quite interesting when, you know, she's determined, isn't she, that Seven of Nine is going to join the crew and regain her, even when, you know, pretty much everyone's saying to her, you know, she's too far gone, like, we can't do it. It might have been worth actually saying, you know, I lost one of my crew to
the Kazon Nistrum. maybe we didn't need to be reminded of that.
As good as Mulgrew is there, at the end of Prime Factors, you know, where she's facing down B'Elanna Torres and she's like, you know, if you disobey my rules again, there will be consequences. and then she has to deal with Chewbacca, and she does the whole scene in like this restrained whisper, like she's on the edge of tears because he's betrayed her. Man, she's good.
Yeah, she is really good. And I love the choice of making the two of them just friends, you know, and there's not enough of that, I think.
They kind of abandon it later on. We get the odd moment where she gives them a birthday cake or something like that, but it's not like the Cisco Dax friendship where there's a lot of complexities for it over time. And it ended. I felt it ended.
And it ended in a bit of a crap way. And it's that sort of stupid, you know, why should me failing make you feel better? And you kind of think, Jesus Christ, come on, you've met people before. What are you talking about? And the reason that Chakotay gives doesn't seem to be the right reason. It's, he says misery loves company, but surely it's like, well, if she fooled Tuvok, then I'm not a massive fucking idiot because Tuvok isn't, you know, that seems to be, don't you think? That would be why he feels better, not just because Tuvok's feeling bad as well. It just seemed like a kind of shitty, tone-deaf kind of way to end it. And it doesn't end up being about anything, you know.
I think one thing that I took away from this was what a crying shame it was to write out Seska at the end of season two, because she is so fucking watchable.
Yeah.
And they don't, Voyager doesn't have a recurring villain
again
after series two. The Borg Queen sort of turns up, but she's so boring. Like,
she
cares?
Only turns up like three times or something, doesn't she? Like,
It's something that DS9 got absolutely right, didn't it? With Dukat and Weyoun and the female shapeshifter and Wynn. And, you know, when these people turned up, you were like, yes, you know, now we're going to get some serious scenery chewing going on here. And there were some people that might, like Anorax from the Year of Hell, potentially could have been a recurring event. There was a pretty dreary but a great premise episode where it's like Hustle. There's a group of people going around pretending that they're from Voyager. Oh, so it's a fake Janeway. And the fake Janeway is actually really good. And she would have been a great recurring villain. But they just don't. They just don't do it. And I just think that's a real shame.
Yeah. I mean, it stops being this show, I think. And, you know, like, it doesn't leave it unable to do good things, because there are good episodes coming up and all sorts of interesting episodes and all sorts of interesting episodes that might not have been possible if we hadn't decided to move through the galaxy and meet a succession of different, you know, adversaries. I think in retrospect, that ends up not being such a bad idea. But you just wish the show was as rich and interesting as this one is, I think.
Yeah. And what's really terrible is when Seska is written out in Basics Part 2, do you remember the scene?
No, I don't think I do.
See, look, and you should remember it when a villain departs the show. And it's basically, she's on the bridge of Voyager with the baby and, like, a bolt hits the ship and then she sort of, like, is reaching off screen. And that's the last we see of her. And it's just nothing.
Oh, okay.
You know, when Wynn left DS9, I know you have some issues with those scenes in the fire caves, but she's stupid. Like, I'll stop you, Dukat. And he goes, are you still here? And kills her. I'll never forget
it. So do they not, they don't properly kill Seska?
It's sort of off screen. It's acknowledged that she was found dead amongst all the Kazon people on the bridge.
Oh, that's super boring.
How boring.
Yeah.
I know. Yeah. It's the Jerry Taylor effect.
Yeah, it is a bit of a shame, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, it's the end of the episode, so it's time for us to pull up UntitledStarTrekProject.com/randomizer. And this week it's Joe's turn to pick. So what series are we choosing from?
What's the most predictable series I could possibly choose?
Deep Space Nine.
That is the series I've chosen. And it's just because I've been watching a few lately, and I just want to, and I know we've done quite a bit of 90s lately, and we will head out soon, but there's a lot of it.
Most of Star Trek is from this era.
So if you will indulge me, I'd like excellent. To do a DS9 episode next.
Okay.
Well, tell me when you're ready.
Oh, I'm ready now. I'm just pressed the button.
Okay. Your random Star Trek Deep Space Nine episode is Season 6, Episode 15, Honor Amongst Thieves.
Is it a Quark episode?
No, it's an O'Brien episode where he is undercover in a pretty well-realized location, actually. It's got Nick Tate from... Is he from...
Skippy.
Space 1999.
And Skippy. Is he from Skippy? He's an Australian anyway.
It's
Isn't he in Final Mission as well? He's in Final Mission.
It's the same guy, yeah. And he gives a really great performance, but it's a little quiet, and so I'm going to press it again.
Okay.
Oh, looking for Pamark in all the wrong places.
Ah, which we covered in episode.
I'll tell you what, something. This randomizer is obsessed with us talking about sex, you know.
Yeah. Well, I wrote it.
Your random Star Trek Deep Space Nine episode is season 5, episode 2, The Ship.
Ooh, I like episode 2 of a season, actually. We resolve the cliffhanger and then head off boldly in another direction. What do you think?
That's one of 2 episodes with a female Vorter.
Ooh.
And a lot of tension. It's pretty dark, that episode. Oh, it's a good one. It is a good one. But unfortunately, I have pressed it again.
Press the button again. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Oh, I really want to do this, but it's part 2 of a 2-parter. We haven't done a DS9 2-parter yet.
I think we have to. The rules are that we have to do both parts.
So it's season 7.
Yeah.
Episode 2, Shadows and Symbols. So it would be Image in the Sand, I think it's called, and Shadows and Symbols.
Now, that's definitely a two-parter because Deep Space Nine does do the thing where they have different titles, like The Die Is Cast and stuff like that. So that is a thing. So I think that we have to...
Sisko on Earth, finding out about his mother. It's the introduction of Esri Dax. It's Kira doing the blockade against... who's the blockade against again? I can't remember now. It's the Romulans. Yeah, Kira against the Romulans, which is amazing. There's lots going on. It's Worf getting over the death of Dax and going on a mission with Quark to get her into Sovacool.
Yeah. I think that sounds great.
Going on. And technically, it is a 3-part. We won't do all 3, but actually the last episode of Series 6 and then the first 2 of Season 7, it is one massive story. But I think we should do 1 and 2 of 7.
Yeah, I'm absolutely on board with that. Let's do that. So series 7 episodes 1 and 2 of Deep Space Nine. I think that's hang time too, because it's sort of shifting a lot of everything,
you know. I think it's one of those examples where DS9 juggles a lot of plots. It builds up some serious momentum and it pays off everyone really well. I think this is quietly an extremely, extremely good DS9 2-parter.
All right, I'm up for it.
Let's do it.
You've been listening to Untitled Star Trek Project with Joe Ford and Nathan Bottomley. We're online at untitledstartrekproject.com, where you can find links to our Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube channel. Our podcast artwork is by Kayla Ciceron, and the theme was composed by Cameron Lamb. This episode was recorded on the 24th of August 2022 and released on the 9th of September. We'll see you next time for Star Trek Deep Space Nine, Image in the Sand, and Shadows and Symbols. Okay,
I'm going to keep audible. Pressing that button until I get Admiral Nechayev. Told you.
How do you know she's in a few DS9s as well? Oh, is she?
Yeah, she's in The Search Part 2. Yeah.
Okay.
She's like, we've signed a peace pact with the Dominion, and I'm giving you a promotion. Congratulations, Captain Sisko.
Oh, is she the one who makes the announcement?
No,
is it?
It's all a fake. It's a big con. They're all strapped to a VR machine.
Oh, okay. I thought she might be a shapeshifter.
So they do all of these mad changes. And you think, what's going on with DS9 in the beginning of Series 3? They collapsed the wormhole and all this stuff's going on. And you're like, oh, okay, yeah. It was all a dream.
Oh, that's a shame. Yeah. Yes. I had sort of hoped that she would be the... Oh, anyway. Oh, Brendan has a question for us, by the way.
What, for this episode?
No, just if it comes up. But it is, why are Noonien Sung, Altan Sung, Arik Sung, and Adam Sung all identical to one another? Except for Noonien Sung, who looks like Brent Spiner in a big kind of latex sack.
Genetic engineering.
Do you think that's what he... Or, yeah, I think. Yeah. I think probably. Or maybe they just wanted to cast Brent and they didn't really give a shit. That's my theory.
I think that is exactly that the right answer.
That is the correct answer. Yeah, that's right. It's just like, Brent wants to be in it.
Brent wants some work. Oh, well, we can get another Soong out of the cupboard. He's not doing anything.
Yeah, that's right.
To be fair, though, half the time when he plays it, when he does Soong in the Augments trilogy in Enterprise, he's brilliant. He's really, I think he's really good.
Different as Adam. I mean, like Adam Soong in Series 2 of Picard, he's... That's a stupid, weird character, but like, whatever.
Is he the one down on that android planet?
No, that's Alton Soong. That's the other Soong in 2022 who is...
Well, there's an awful lot of Soongs out there, I'm telling you.
Who's the father of, not Soji, whatever she's called. Anyway, the same woman. What's her face?
Okay.
Yeah. All right, let's properly do this.
Mm.
I think that that's the tag because Brendan said we should talk about it. And I think we can put that in at the end.
Yeah.
Don't you reckon? Yeah. Yeah. Oh, so we just have to wait until we get the Augments trilogy.
A fistful of Soongs.
Yeah, that's right. All right. Here goes.